Hello, my name is Justin Fonksavon. I'm a 22-year-old Paralympic athlete from Iowa. I'm currently located in Chula Vista, California at the Chula Vista Elite Athlete Training Center, and I am a professional javelin thrower. I am classed as a F54, which means I am paralyzed from the chest down and I need a wheelchair to get around everywhere. So this is the first podcast that I'm doing, and I'm just going to be very vague and get into a little about how I got into the Paralympics, how I got injured at the age of 18, and a little bit of who I was before I was put into a chair. So first, let's start with who I was before I got put into the chair. It was October 25th, 2015 at around 10:38 p.m. when I was paralyzed. Leading up to it, I graduated in 2015 from Ankeny Centennial High School. I participated in football, wrestling, track, and rugby throughout my high school career. I wrestled for 8 years, and I also played football since grade school with a lot of friends. Did track since my freshman year, and I did rugby for 2 years. So I was an all-around athlete growing up. I hung out with the athletic crowd. I was a little bit of a troublemaker growing up. Got into a little bit of trouble. Then once I got to high school, didn't get any better. Finally graduated, became an electrician. Upon becoming an electrician, I became an electrician on my 18th birthday, which is May 19th. Following graduation in January, I worked at Walgreens and did subcontracting for a contractor and just started working the construction and doing blue-collar jobs. College was never something that I wanted to attend or go through, so I went to trade school instead to make money as fast as I could and grew up a little bit faster than everyone around me. It wasn't until 5 months into my apprenticeship in electrical that I found myself buying an RV, hanging out with my friends, having parties in this RV at campsites all over the state of Iowa and Polk County. And it was one night on October 25th, we parked the RV, me and my friend Nick Culver. Before the festivities began, we got hungry and we wanted to go to the new McDonald's that was located in the town that we graduated in, which is Ankeny, Iowa. And so we went there, we sat down for about 5 minutes. We got our food and we thought it'd be funny to pull a little prank before we left to make a scene like we've seen all over the internet. So when we're leaving, my friend Nick Culver looked at his burgers and he's like, "I got pickles on this burger." And when he left, he made a scene in a way that he football spiked his burger on the ground and said, "F this place." And then we left. Immediately upon leaving, me and him laughed because as we thought it was a joke. And we go to our car to get ready in our car to leave. We're talking over the car about something. And it wasn't another 1 minute later that an individual came up behind my friend Nick and garnished a gun, pistol whipped him across the face, pointed the gun at him, and asked if he thought what he did in there was funny. Unbeknownst to me, this guy actually followed us right after we left the McDonald's. He went to his car, grabbed his gun, and then proceeded to initiate a confrontation with us. So after he pistol whipped my friend Nick is gushing blood from his forehead. He is backed into a corner between his car and his door, which is open, so he's pinned with the guy pointing a gun at him. I immediately take action. I run across the car. I go around and I get in between the perpetrator and Nick. So I start trying to defuse the situation. At first, I was aggressive. I was cursing, yelling at him, trying to just defuse everything, but at a state of panic as well. Following my actions, he immediately took 2 steps back because taking into consideration that at this time I was standing 6 foot tall, 240 pounds, an all-conference football player, defensive lineman. And he takes a couple steps back. He immediately chambers around into his gun, which means he cocks back the slide and he puts a bullet into the chamber that's ready to be shot. So at this situation, I'm panicking. I'm terrified for my life and Nick's life. I immediately retract any aggression that I had, and I sympathize and plead with him to go on his way. This was a mistake. It's our fault. We apologize. Anything that I could do or say to make the situation better is what I would do. And he just relentlessly cursed, yelled at us, and gave us everything that we deserved to have verbally. And it wasn't probably that whole confrontation probably went on for about 4 or 5 minutes of just screaming, cursing, yelling at each other, and him putting a gun at us the whole time, never leaving our faces. And right before, his wife came out of the restaurant and defused the situation, he asked both of us if we were ready to die while pointing the gun at our heads and asking us that question with the bullet in the chamber. So with the chills down our spine, we just pleaded with him and asking him everything that we can. His wife comes out and immediately says, "Stop, stop. His name's Gabriel Coco. Stop, Gabriel. Don't do this." And then I look at her and I say, "Please don't. Please stop. Like, just come grab your husband." And she's like, "He's a veteran with PTSD, et cetera, et cetera." And we're just like, "Okay, that's fine. Just please let us get out of here." And then when she came out, grabbed him, he lowered the gun finally. And this is all about 7 minutes has passed. And Nick is still bleeding from his head because his head was gashed open from the pistol whip. Once his wife comes and grabs him, he spits a couple words at us and we don't say anything. I tend to Nick, make sure he's okay. And once I see that him and his wife are in the car or heading towards the car, I go to the passenger side of the car and try to grab my phone in order to call the police. That's when I get to the other side of the car. My door is open. I immediately turn around to get the license plate, and that's when I see Gabriel Coco standing at his door, which is the driver's side, opened up, mounted, and aiming his gun directly at me. That's when I take 1 step away from the car to get ready to run. Shot. Gunfire. I get shot once in the leg. And then I immediately stop and I get a shot again and this one misses. I get 1 more step ahead and I keep looking at him shooting at me. And this is when I was struck in the upper arm right behind the shoulder blade. And it immediately caused my paralysis. I dropped like a sack of potatoes, immediately paralyzed, nothing that I could do. So when I fell to the floor, I knew I was paralyzed immediately. I tried to stand up. I tried to get up and run. I couldn't. I laid there, looked at the night sky, thinking, is this going to be the end of my life? Is this going to be the end of Nick's life? What's going to happen next? 2 more shots rain. So that's a total of 5 shots so far. I see Nick fall through the car because both the doors are open. Nick falls, and the other shot before that missed. And so now I think Nick's dead. I'm screwed. I'm paralyzed. I can't move. So I stare up at the sky. I look back at the guy and his wife who's screaming at him to stop. And they get in their car. They drive. They circle and they go around to look at us. And the wife just stares at me on the ground as I'm bleeding profusely. Nick's on the other side. Nick gets up shortly after they leave, 10 seconds maybe after they get out of our site and comes over to me, gushing blood from his forehead all the way down to his chin, dripping everywhere. And he asks me if I'm good and that we need to go. And I say, I can't move. My legs don't work anymore. I'm paralyzed. Obviously, this is a lot more than the conversation that we had, just because I was shot through the lung. And so I couldn't talk. It was hard to breathe. And I was in excruciating pain from the hole that was in my arm. So it was really, it's hard to talk at that moment. But I did tell him, I am paralyzed and I can't move. So he said, fuck. He sat there next to me, grabbed his phone, called the police as he's gushing blood from his head this whole time. And that's when we wait there. We sit there 10 minutes. Just what the fuck is all we said. And then 10 minutes later, make sure I'm okay. I make sure he's okay. And ambulance comes. They pick me up and they ask, like, what happened? And we said we both got shot. And it was a mystery to how I got paralyzed, because I was shot in the arm from the side. The paramedics couldn't figure it out right away. They were like, why can't you walk? We don't understand. You got shot in the arm. There's no exit wound, so the bullet must still be inside you. I could not talk. I'm spitting up blood. I'm sucking in blood. My lung is just filling up with blood. And so I was able to muster out my mom's phone number and my ex-girlfriend now, but my girlfriend at the time's number, who was at college about 30 minutes north of where I got shot. So we rushed me to the hospital. This whole time I'm conscious, just looking at the paramedics, looking at the lights, driving downtown. At this point, it's been about 17 minutes since I've been shot. We pull into the ER at the hospital. Nick goes one way, tells me he loves me and hopes everything's going to be okay. I go towards the ICU. So Nick's medical treatment, all he had to do was, when he got shot, the bullet got lodged in his arm due to a ricochet, is what we were told. And that's why the bullet didn't go in anymore. It went about halfway in. And then he shot us with a 45 caliber handgun. So his bullet went in halfway, almost in the same area that I got shot, but he was further away. I was about 6 or 7 yards away from him when I got shot, and Nick was about on the other side of the car, probably 9 yards away. So I'm pulling to the hospital, and I go in the ICU, and I immediately get sedated. So now it's just, they're figuring out, what can we do with him? Why is he paralyzed? They got neurologists there, neurosurgeons, doctors, nurses of all sorts. And this is when they find the prognosis. They say, hey, you know, this bullet is lodged in your T2 and you have 5 other fragments just floating around in you due to the bullet that he shot us with was a hollow point. So it just shattered. It just went in all different shards. So I got 4 shards just flown around, and then one went perfectly in between the T2, T3 vertebrae and just severed the spinal cord 95% of the way through. And it's lodged in there. So they decided that it was the best option not to operate immediately due to the fact that it could cause mass infection, end up doing more damage than it would good, and that because it was stable, it went in there sterile, because the bullet goes in so hot that there's no chance that it would cause infection unless it hit something and I went septic. But because it just went through my lung, all they had to do was throw a chest tube in my lung, and that was it. So I sat there for 24 hours. The news picked it up immediately. Once the news picked it up, I mean, everybody and anybody in my town came and supported. We had hundreds of people come. People I haven't talked to in years, that people reached out from my high school. Everyone came and rallied around me at the hospital and hoped for the best for me. It was about 48 hours in, is when I woke up, I was conscious. I knew what happened to me. I didn't have the harsh reality that I was paralyzed until the neurologist came in and told me that I would never walk again because the bullet severed my spine and there's no fixing a severed spine. Of course, she came in 3 more times and said that, and it cost us like $15,000 every time she walked in that door. So, I mean, you know, I got the message and I respected it. So, coming from a kid who is an all-conference defensive lineman, did football, wrestling, track, and rugby, had a beautiful girlfriend, and had a great job with a great boss and a great work environment, going from having everything that a 18-year-old could ever want to his whole life shattering in a McDonald's parking lot because of a bad prank was a lot to process immediately. It was, I'm not going to say it was easy, because there's no way anybody could go through what this or any traumatic experience in their life and have it be easy to come back to their right mind. So it took me 3 days just to be able to sit up in my bed in the hospital. And upon sitting up, I had a IV in my neck because the ones in my arm started to blow. Pop or burst or whatever the medical terminology is for it. I also had a PICC line in, had a catheter in, and I had my chest tube in. So it was a full 72 hours I laid on my back, not knowing fully what happened the first 24 hours, 24 hours of realization, and then finally 24 hours of social influence with everyone that came and saw me. I was able to spend time with them, my loved ones, my family, and make sure that I was okay mentally. After 3 days, 72 hours, I finally sat up. The doctors helped me. I almost passed out. I mean, I was laying almost flat for 72 hours. It was a lot as a head rush to sit up. This is when the severity of my situation really hit me. It wasn't just that I'm paralyzed. I can't move my legs and I can't walk. There's so much more to a spinal cord, and let alone a spinal cord injury, that people don't think about, people don't know, and I didn't know. My ignorance to the spinal cord and everything with a spinal cord injury was tremendous. So when I sat up, they told me, you know, you don't have any abs function anymore. You cannot move your abs. You cannot use your abs. You cannot flex them. And the same thing goes for the back. You can't use your lower back, can't use your mid back. All you can use is your chest and your arms. And when I look at the doctor, I say, you know, wow, how am I supposed to live my life? How do I, after 3 days, I didn't even know how I was supposed to go to the bathroom, let alone how am I supposed to get from this seat to anything. How do I sit up on my own when I don't have a core to pull me up? It was all explained to me later in physical therapy, where I can get into later. And when my mom finally came, my mom was there first thing. She came there by 12 o'clock is when I got to the, or 11:45 is when I got to the ICU, and my mom showed up immediately. She didn't know what happened. The doctors didn't tell her right away because they don't know what was going on, and they basically just told my mom that I got shot. And then following her was my girlfriend at the time's mom, and then my girlfriend at the time also showed up. Her name is Gabby Weatherwax. She showed up with her mom, Lisa, which I dated Gabby from off and on since 7th grade all the way up to past our senior year and into freshman year in college. And so she was there immediately. Lisa was there immediately. Everyone's there. Nick was there in the ICU getting stitches in his head and getting the bullet taken out of his arm. Nick's mom was there. Everyone who could be there at 11:30 at night on a Saturday was there. So I sit up. I was told again, this is what you're going to have to do every day. And I lay back. It is now Tuesday or Wednesday. And I'm still in my bed in the ICU. I asked for my phone. My phone is with the police and evidence for the video that I took when it all happened. So in the beginning when we did the prank, I did film it because I did think it would be a funny prank to do. And now looking back, it was so stupid. I mean, there's so many lessons that I've learned from this whole instance that happened almost 4 years ago. But beside the point, and that's something for another story. And we, 4 days in, I don't have a phone, don't have social media. I'm not realizing what's happening on the outside world, if any of my immediate friends or other friends know what's happening. Turn on the TV. I have reporters all over my room, unbeknownst to me, because my mom and my girlfriend at the time was just pushing everyone out to give me my time, my space to process everything that's going on. So I am just watching TV, carrying on with my day, just getting into my head. And let's just fast forward to 12 days in. 12 days in, I've had an immense amount of support. Friends, family that came in, brought me food. I'm probably down 35 pounds at this time. I came in to the hospital at 6 foot, 240 pounds. Now I'm about sitting at 205 at this point in time. And losing all of my muscle mass, losing muscular dystrophy in my legs because they aren't being used anymore, so they're shrinking, and my everything on me is just shrinking, hair's growing. It was a point in my time that at about this 12-day mark, I've had solidarity and time to myself more than I've ever had. There was days where I wouldn't see anyone, talk to anyone, and I would wake up and not be able to fall back asleep for 5-6 hours. And there just comes a point where you do something over and over too much where you don't want to do it anymore. So I stopped watching TV, and what I would do is I would stare at my ceiling in almost lucid dream, but I wouldn't dream. I would think about the past, the present, the future, what I have yet to get, and what was taken. It was just a lot of time to really mentally prepare myself for a life with a spinal cord injury, a life in a wheelchair, and a life with all of the medical, basically everything that has to do with a spinal cord injury. There's so much that has to do with it. And so I come to a point on day 12 or 13 and I come to my senses. I find a good place spiritually, I find a good place mentally, and I basically just take a step in the right direction and say, why am I sitting here crying over spilled milk, wishing that I had back something that I could never get back? I am in this situation. There's no going back to who I was before. Of course, I still have the memories and want that, but I can't. It's impossible. So why not accept it and move on? I'm not going to cry over spilled milk for too long. So that was when I said, all right, I'm going to grab the bulls by the horn, and I'm going to make the best of the situation in this life. Because when in doubt, if I want it out, there's always one way out guaranteed. And that's in a casket by self-harm. If I ever wanted to do that, that's always my option to have. I never got to the point where I wanted that. I never thought my situation was so bad that that's the best way out. I care too much about my mother. I love her to death. I care too much about my friends. I care too much about my family. And I care too much about myself to take that all away from anyone and everyone and myself. So I come to the realization that, hey, you know, it's time to get my shit together. It's time to move on. So immediately, I kick my training into high gear, my physical therapy, my occupational therapy. I start doing things more and training harder to become independent, to learn more about my disability, and to find more avenues and ventures that I can do once I leave the hospital. And this whole time behind the scenes, my mother is doing everything she can for me in the aspect of paperwork, trying to get funds, social media presence, getting a GoFundMe, Social Security set up, finding organizations to help us make our house more accessible. Also, making sure at the same time that the guy who shot me is getting justice, which he was apprehended. He turned himself in 30 minutes prior to shoot, 30 minutes following shooting me, and got charged, bailed out, and then was charged again with attempted murder, and then bailed out, and they continued to be on bail for a year after that until trial, which he postponed, and then was later found guilty of a bunch of charges, which I can get into in another podcast. And so once I started kicking my PT into high gear, my occupational therapy into high gear, I was ready to go home. I was ready to go home after 16 days. I was fully independent. I could go to the bathroom. I could shower. I could transfer on my own. I can do wheelies. I could go up things. I could work out slightly. And I had a good sense of and a good foundation of what I can do to work on more in the real world instead of having to live in a hospital. But it wasn't time for me to go home. My house wasn't ready. It was November. I had to get an elevator put in my mom's house so I could get to the basement because it's a split foyer. So that wasn't an option. I couldn't go home. So we had to go to another rehab facility. We tried going to a spinal cord injury rehab facility in Colorado called Craig. It's the best spinal cord injury rehab facility in the nation. We tried our hardest to go there. It was filled. We couldn't go there. So we looked up our options, and then we went to the second best. Went to a place called Madonna Hospital, and that was in Omaha, Nebraska. They didn't want to accept me at first because I was fully independent and they didn't think that I needed more rehab. And I low-key agreed with them, but I needed somewhere to go. I needed somewhere to live. I was done at Mercy. We made it prominent that I didn't need any more services. They couldn't provide me anything that I couldn't learn any further with their staff because they weren't specialized in spinal cord injury rehabilitation, and like Madonna was. So my girlfriend at the time, Gabby's mom, knew someone at the hospital because she was high ranked in the medical industry and pulled some strings, got me in, and I moved out there on November 4th, the day before Thanksgiving. We drove out there. My mom came out there with me. We saw the facility, and me and her had Thanksgiving together, just her and I in my room. And she left the following day. Then I did rehab and everything there for about another 2 weeks. Mastered everything they gave me. I was able to transfer from couches to wheelchairs, from the ground to wheelchairs, do wheelie up to curbs. I could transfer from my bed to a toilet, from toilet to my chair, from chair to shower. I could almost do everything independently. And at this point, my fine motor skills are good. My breathing's good. My lung has repaired. I have a normal bowel and bladder routine. I can do everything independently. I just need to be tested in the real world and have somewhere to live in order to do that. We're still looking at the end of December or November, almost beginning of December. It's still not time. The ground is frozen solid. It's hard to dig into the ground in Iowa in December to pour footings and to pour a elevator shaft when the ground's frozen. It's nearly impossible. But with the help of our community, the help of organizations around my town and the capital city of Des Moines, Iowa, they were able to rally a team around that could do it for us for a good price because they knew who I was, they knew the situation. So I finally get the okay to leave Madonna in late November, early December, and it's still not time. We need at least 3 more months, maybe 2 more months at this time to get the house ready. So that's when we need to find another rehab facility I can go to. Luckily, we found a transitional one to acute rehab in Lincoln, Nebraska, called QLI, Quality Living something. And so I transitioned over there. And when I say that this place changed my life and for the better in every aspect, I really mean it. QLI was the best rehab facility for spinal cord injury, traumatic brain injury, coming over an injury from age or anything of the sort. The staff, knowledgeable on spinal cord injuries and knows what it takes to coach, to help, to observe from afar, but not be too into the process and baby patient too much. So, of course, they cooked for us in the beginning. They surveyed us. They watched us from afar and made sure to see what our limitations were and how much we could do. So the rehab facility is set up as we get our own room. We make our own bed. They cook us food, but teach us how to cook food and give us days where we cook food, give us a social living aspect, give us our physical therapy, occupational therapy, but then offer extracurricular activities. Let's say it was winter, so we couldn't do much outside, but we could play ping pong. They had a rec room where we could play games, basketball, pool. They had a swimming pool. They had rock climbing. We could go to a shooting range on these days. They had things that we could do that made staying in a rehab facility with other people in wheelchairs that had the same issues more bearable, more fun, more bonding. We got to know everyone in all over the United States and the Midwest. Newly disabled individuals came to this spinal cord injury facility. And you get to hear some amazing stories. You get to see people's outlooks on life, which good, bad, how they're handling it, how you're handling it. It really makes you appreciate what you have, because it could always be worse, or it could have been ultimately the worst case scenario, and you couldn't have been here. I couldn't have been here. So I finally made friends with other people in wheelchairs after hearing their stories. They hear my story. We all have a connection due to our injury. So I'm fully independent. I'm working out all the time. I'm playing games. I'm going rock climbing. I'm going to the shooting range. I'm going swimming. I'm doing PT every day. I mean, I'm meeting people. And everything was going good. And then I finally got the call on February 14th to come home. My house is ready. The elevator is put in. The bathroom is modified. My bedroom is modified. I have a bed. Everything is ready for me to come home. And that's where I'm going to end the podcast today. Don't know how often I'll be doing podcasts, but I will give you another update on how I came home, what happened with the transition, the goals that I set and that I achieved, and also my crazy love life at this time in my life. And so there's a lot more cool stories to come. Message me if you like this. Make sure to follow me on Instagram at jfongsavan, phongsavanh. And thank you, everyone that listened.